Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we are talking, the European Union and where we're going, and actually a bit more international news. Speaking of someone who never actually looks beyond the confines of Ashburn, Martin, how are you keeping?
Yeah, that's for my sins. I'm trapped out here, Tony. You know, us dubs shifted out here. Great, actually. Busy. You know, I'm in the Public Accounts Committee on the 30th of this month, which is tomorrow week. And we're doing a podcast with Mick Clifford. Was it tomorrow, Tony? We're doing the podcast with Mick Clifford?
Yeah, you're doing a pod with Mick Clifford, yeah. You and your pal.
So we'll be doing a whole bogus self-employment, and it'll be interesting. It will be interesting. I know people's lights turn off when I talk about it, but like, it's €1 billion a year. So get your act together and listen.
Yeah, no. No, in fairness, hopefully next week now it's years of work have gone into this. Hopefully now in the PAC, you'll have your moment. But also, I do think, as much as I give you grief, fair play to you, you do stick at it. You are relentless for better and for worse. Quite often for worse. Anyway, reminder, guys, the link is out for this next Sunday show. It's on patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And there are a couple of live shows coming. Rory on Reboot is approaching its 100th episode in the season, and they're going to be a live podcast also available on patreon.com/tortoiseshack. So if you're interested, you know, just click in. It'll be a bit of crack. Enough plugging. We are thrilled to be joined on the line via Zoom by Europe correspondent at Euronews, by Shona Murray. Shona, how are you keeping?
I'm good. The weather is much brighter here in Brussels, so that's good, because it rained all through January and February and it was miserable. So there is a little bit of positivity with spring in the air, and obviously everyone's still waiting for vaccines, and the cases have gone up here in Belgium. But actually, it's just I'm feeling a little bit more hopeful in the past few weeks.
Yeah, actually, it's funny. I know a few people, Irish people in Belgium. It's quite a little community of Irish people that are active as well on social media, that are Belgian based, and they talk about the kind of sort of numbers, how they've gone up and down. And we have seen, you know, the start of a fourth wave, perhaps is how it's been referred to.
Yeah, and actually, Belgium has been locked down pretty much since the end of October, early November, when, do you remember, Ireland went into lockdown. Mm-hmm. But actually, we didn't reopen at Christmas time, so there was no reopening of bars or restaurants. But what they have done is they've opened retail, you know, non-essential retail, parks are open, you know, there's little wildlife zoos that you can go to as well that are open. So there is a feeling that, you know, there is much more of a community. But at the same time, like I've noticed in the past 3 weeks, because the weather's been nice on the Saturday, the park is thronged with people. But you're talking about like sort of gangs of kids and people in their 20s and really enjoying themselves, having a few cans and eating food. And normally you just look at that and think that's great, because they're not in any way impinging on anybody, other than it's just clear that they've given up on trying to, you know, engage in the regulations. So that is worrying, especially when you see the traffic levels go up. And on a Saturday, because I live in the city centre near the sort of high street, people queuing outside Zara and all the high street shops to go in shopping on a Saturday, and it doesn't bode well.
Yeah, and the numbers, we've seen our numbers are stubbornly high. I'm sure you watch back home all the time, and they are not in decline. Actually, they're on the way back up, and if you look at the trends, and that is across the board in Europe at the moment, in many of the main countries. But I suppose one of the real reasons I've been trying to talk to you for ages, but one of the things now that is pertinent today is the reason that what we're seeing is the EU itself behind the curveball, behind the eight ball, and getting things done, and it's been underwhelming, the performance. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think there's two things. You know, they have to look at the EU's responsibility in procuring vaccines and developing vaccines, or at least manufacturing them, and then the rollout, because that's nothing to do with the EU. Member states are responsible for their own rollout. The Commission isn't responsible for that, and so there is it's very diffuse. If you look at countries like Malta. Malta is almost as good as the UK, and it is in the EU system. Same with Denmark, was doing really well. It suspended AstraZeneca, and they had their own responsibility and their own method of getting the vaccines into people's arms. And so that's one way of looking at it. Those other countries, Belgium's not doing well at all, and so on. Bulgaria is doing very badly. But then the EU's responsibility was to procure the vaccines for all the 27 member states, and that is definitely a good idea, and no, you know, it's inarguable, because if the EU didn't do it for all 27 member states, you'd have bigger countries like Germany or even the Netherlands, because they manufacture the vaccines, they would get all the vaccines. And Ireland would probably get no vaccines. Smaller countries that don't have negotiating heft wouldn't get any access to vaccines. At least in this way, it was given on a pro rata basis, depending on your population. So it was fair, and it meant that you didn't have countries fighting it out for vaccines. Now, where the EU has fallen down is they didn't ensure the supply was guaranteed, in particular ensuring that the manufacturing places in the Netherlands, in Belgium, in parts of Germany, where they do manufacture all the vaccines and vaccine raw materials, that they weren't as secure. That was one big problem. And the second thing is the very controversial contract with AstraZeneca, which the UK has, it appears, a better, we haven't seen the full UK contract, but it appears a clause which means that the UK population has to be facilitated first, even though the EU would argue, when you look at their contract, it says actually the EU contract should be supplied by all AstraZeneca's plants in the UK, EU, and so on.
Yeah, and on the AstraZeneca one, it's actually, timing-wise, the EU were, there's a kind of misunderstanding out there in the public domain that the UK were in there first. They weren't. The EU's orders were placed earlier.
A day earlier.
Yeah, you know, so you know, I'm not here to just kick the EU, and that's certainly, and I accept as a member of a small state that it's better to be able to negotiate. We've got better pricing. But we've also seen Ursula von der Leyen in recent days talking about keeping hold what we have kind of mentality. And that is something that, obviously, if you've listened to this podcast, we kind of think along terms of vaccine capitalism and vaccine inequality. And we need the responsibility to the other nations beyond our borders. Has that gone down? How has that been received broadly?
Well, so on the basis of, so it doesn't, it excludes anyone that's in COVAX. So the 92 countries in the developing world, obviously they won't, there would be no changes to that. And it excludes other countries that are like Switzerland and the EU area. But what it includes is countries that aren't reciprocating, first of all, because the EU's position is the UK doesn't have a formal ban on exporting vaccines, but it isn't exporting to the EU, yet the EU is exporting to the UK. So it's about reciprocal arrangements, saying, well, we're going to do free trade as well, but you have to do the same thing. And also it's proportionality. So they don't believe that they should be exporting to countries that have a high proportion of vaccines when the EU doesn't have them, and when some of those companies aren't actually fulfilling their own contract to the EU. So it is, you know, it's much more narrow than that. But it's gone down as a mixed bag. You know, we heard Neil Martin even saying yesterday that Ireland wouldn't be for raising the bar on this, because you end up having tit for tat. And then also remembering that the raw materials of the vaccines, they come from various different parts of Europe and the world as well. So even though the EU, in theory, is fair enough to say to the UK, well, hold on a minute, this is fair, reciprocate. And we, you know, the EU has sent 10 million vaccines in the last 6 weeks to the UK, and the UK is flying it when it comes to vaccinations. Mm-hmm. But the point is, well, you need to do the right thing and send them back. And I think that the political discussion has to come into play here, rather than the EU saying, well, we're not exporting to you, because the situation between the UK and the EU is so tense in so many areas that we just wouldn't really need a ratcheting up.
Is there any hope that the EU will allow importation of the Russian vaccine? They're offering it to us at the moment, and it doesn't seem to be any rush to take it up.
No, there is a rolling review of it now. So the Russia applied for EMA authorization about 4 weeks ago, in around that. So they do a review of the data, and that'll take some time, because it's new data, and then they'll do, you know, trials. So no, they're definitely open to that. But I think that the initial strategy was to do only vaccines that have like some plants in the EU in terms of certification. And that was the initial idea. So they are looking at that. The only concern is as well is that Russia actually is one of the worst in Europe for vaccinations of their own people. It's only around 6% or something. So the EU's position is, well, look, even if we do accept it as a unauthorized vaccine, do we know that Russia is going to be able to supply in the volume we need in time? Because And it, the other thing is, which is the more optimistic element, which is that, that the EU should have 355 million doses in the second quarter. 55 million of those is the Johnson & Johnson, which is one vaccine. So if by the time Russia Sputnik does come on stream, we may not need it. But I don't, I think that there's look, there is geopolitics involved, and there's a lack of trust for in terms of Russia. But there's also many politicians here in Brussels I speak to who say politics should be kept out of it. We should look at the data. Sputnik looks like a great vaccine. And the EMA, in fairness to it, is a it's a non-political entity, and they are looking at the data, and they have started a rolling review.
In Ireland here, we have a perception that rollout is very lax, that it's not happening fast enough. Does that perception persist in other European countries? Are we all in the same boat, or are we worse?
Ireland's actually doing quite well. I don't have a figure in front of me. It's around 10th, I'd say, in the whole of Europe. But I'm not just talking about the EU. I'm talking about sort of Russia and the UK and so on. So I think the Irish government's position, which is that they get the vaccines in and they get them into people's arms pretty straightforwardly. Other countries are much better, like Denmark and Malta. Malta and Denmark did something where they prioritised Pfizer BioNTech, and they got the needles in place, and they were ready to roll that out straight away. And what had happened was, when back in 2020, when the member states were and the EU was negotiating the contract, some countries, Bulgaria, for example, Austria, didn't take up their pro rata of Pfizer BioNTech, because at the time everyone thought AstraZeneca was going to be the key to the vaccine rollout. Nobody knew that supply was going to be an issue. And so Denmark bought up a lot of Bulgaria's Pfizer-BioNTech, so did Malta. They took the opportunity. Now, I know that Ireland did manage to get 138,000 extra through this process as well, but other countries jumped on it, and Germany did similarly. Also, Pfizer-BioNTech was more expensive, so that's why other countries weren't going for it. And as we know, AstraZeneca was a much easier, more practical vaccine, because it doesn't have to be stored in such lower conditions. So back in 2020, some countries said, you know what, we're going to go with Pfizer-BioNTech, even though at the time, everyone thought AstraZeneca was going to be the savior and was going to be out first. And then everything fell apart when AstraZeneca said, actually, we're going to give you less than half of what you're owed in the first quarter, and the same in the second quarter.
You've mentioned it now twice, and once in relation to, but you mentioned the geopolitics of this. Obviously, the Europe-Russia relationship is one thing, but the Europe-UK one has never been as strained in many regards. And there has been, like, the ball was dropped by the EU in the Northern Protocol, and how that happened. I know it was only for a few hours, and we can caveat it all and say that they backed down on it, but it emboldened a certain side of the UK politics to the point where I saw, even, you know, tweeting this morning yourself, sharing an article where someone saying treat the EU as a hostile entity now. It's pretty grim when it comes to that kind of the relationship in the midst of a global pandemic.
It's really worrying. I think it's really worrying, actually, because it has deteriorated so vastly over the past few years because of Brexit. But also, particularly this British government that exists now is quite hostile to the EU, has been. But remember, you know, the EU's position for the past 4 years has been to protect Northern Ireland. And it has dominated Brussels like you wouldn't believe. And there are member states like Hungary and Estonia who don't have a close consciousness to the Good Friday Agreement, but they still rolled in behind Ireland, even though at times the Hungarians and others have citizens living in the UK that may lose their citizenship. They had a, you know, and so all along the Commission has done that. And I do think, I mean, then before Christmas, we had the Internal Markets Bill where the UK was going to breach the protocol. And similarly, they've done that now. And I do agree that what happened with the Article 16 issue was, I mean, inexcusable. But actually, I also think that on the basis of what the EU has actually done, the Commission has done for Ireland, it is forgivable. It's not, you know, and what the UK has done recently in terms of breaching the protocol by extending grace periods unnecessarily, that is much more, I think, aggressive. But I think you're right. It has been exploited. That mistake has been exploited and has ratcheted up tensions. But it's been given, the EU gave, that basically was a known goal. They gave the opportunity to Arlene Foster and so on. It was manna for heaven for people like them to say, oh, the mask has slipped. Hamas didn't slip. The commission made a mistake. Some people made a mistake after a week of, you know, rancor and bitterness over AstraZeneca. But the issue was rectified, and we have to move on from that.
On the scale of crises that the EU is dealing with at the present moment in time, does the Ireland-UK relationship rank up there, or is it on the back boiler while they're dealing with COVID?
I think it definitely ranks up there. It's huge because everything is seen through the prism of Brexit now. So if you look at the UK narrative, they're talking about, you know, EU nationalism, von der Leyen, and all sorts of references to 1939, all sorts of stuff. That's really just hysterical. And yet they don't take into play the context that, look, the UK just hasn't exported any vaccines. And that, like, there's no ban, but there's a de facto ban if EU is sending 10 million Pfizer to a country that has brilliant vaccine rollout and the UK won't share. So that is a problem. And then also the protocol is hugely problematic because, remember, you know, if the protocol doesn't work over the next couple of years and the UK continue to breach international law, extending grace periods, not working with the EU, what happens to Ireland, the island of Ireland? Then it's Ireland's position in the single market is comes under threat. And the UK government know all this because they, remember, were one of the most constructive members of the single market. I mean, they always say Margaret Thatcher created the single market. The British were so constructive and brilliant when it came to the single market. They know exactly what this will do to Ireland and exactly how difficult it is for the EU as well. And it is a huge, I think it's the main priority because forevermore, the UK is still going to be there. And I think many in the EU would like to have a good relationship. Remember, they do work well in other areas. Yesterday, we saw sanctions against four people in China over the genocide of the Uyghur. And the UK sanctioned the same people as the EU. And so that's where you have multilateralism working together. And there's a hope that that can continue. But at the moment, it's just not good.
I'm really trying to put this together in my head because they have extended the grace period again in terms of the protocol and what's been happening. We saw, I don't know if you watched last night, we had a debate on Irish TV with Claire Byrne Live around, you know, the debate that wouldn't have been possible pre-Brexit around the idea of a united Ireland and where this is heading. And we saw the position of unionists outlined adamantly, like, and that is very clear and very adamant. And I'm not here to debate that other than to say, you know, that will be something that is going to have to be dealt with. But have we left ourselves vulnerable to if this extends on beyond, whereby it does leave Brussels in the position whereby, because they have been very good, the standing by Ireland for the last number of years. As the mood music hasn't changed there, I'm right in saying?
No, it hasn't changed. But I think there's real annoyance at how the UK is being so aggressive. I mean, actually, because there had been hope. Remember, Maros Sefcovic and Michael Gove actually had quite a good relationship, a working relationship. So they were discussing together extending the grace periods because everyone recognised the protocol was not working, obviously, because nobody had a plan in place to implement it, seeing as it was only negotiated on the 24th of December. So everybody agreed, look, these would have to be extended. So there was no need for David Frost to do that unilaterally, other than to say, I'm in charge now, and this is what's happening. Because he could have done it in the joint committee with others and sat down and said, look, if we extend, then this is how we implement the protocol. Here's the plan. And the EU is looking for a plan. They didn't get one. So, I mean, the impact is not good. The mood music hasn't changed, but I think everyone's just worried about an increasingly aggressive UK government.
Shona, I just want to move briefly on. And again, you can tell me you haven't seen much on this, but in terms of the recovery funds, in terms of the EU recovery funds and how things have been handled there. I mean, again, from Ireland's perspective, we saw that the pot is smaller because of our GDP figures and how that's working. How has it been judged broadly that the EU has reacted? I mean, we put this in context of the global financial crisis. It's infinitely better in my opinion, but how has it been perceived on mainland Europe, in your opinion?
Actually, they see it as a momentous thing because it was the first time, as we know, that the EU would borrow off the back of all member states. So it was a moment where the EU actually came much closer when it comes to economics and fiscal union. And it was momentous because, you know, there are countries that we know, like the Netherlands and Finland and others, who were against these grants because they didn't need them at the time. But at the same time, they said, you know what, in the interest of actually reviving the whole of the EU's economy and the Eurozone economy, we will have to give it. And millions and millions of that money is going to go to Italy and Spain and Greece, for those countries who we saw were traumatized this time last year with COVID. So it's seen as a great thing at the moment, but it's how it's going to be rolled out. Obviously, it's going to be a huge test, because if it's not rolled out properly, you know, they've lost the room in terms of closer relationship when it comes to a fiscal union. And there is obviously worries about that. But most of the member states are now putting in their proposals. The proposals have to be aligned with EU values around climate change and sustainability. They can't just be like, oh, we're going to put up a motorway here and, you know, and so on. They have to be cleverly, you know, tested. And the hope is that the money will be well used on issues like health and so on.
That is the hope, that it will be used. But there's not much sign of the money being used here in Ireland. We have this mindset that the books need to be balanced, and austerity is the next step, where we're going from COVID recovery will be austerity. Is there that sense across other countries in Europe?
I wouldn't. You know, that's, I suppose it's every individual country to make those decisions, and it depends on what government is in place, obviously. For example, Mario Draghi, former head of the central bank, like he's there. He's seen as sort of a technocrat. But Italy has gotten so much money that you'd imagine that austerity is not the way forward. And I think there's an acknowledgement that the austerity years after the banking crisis were a disaster. They allowed the far right to breathe. They caused so much economic hardship towards people unnecessarily. Taxpayers who didn't do anything wrong, losing their jobs. The people of Greece, I was in Greece in 2015 for a lot of times, you know, with Syriza and, you know, looking at those protests that were taking place and how desolate and despondent Greek people were during that time. I don't think anyone wants that repeated again. So I think that they knew. That is the realization that was the wrong method at the time, and that's why they've built this 750 billion euro rescue fund, so that instead of actually imposing austerity on people, you give money to those countries with pretty much from a grant system, so you don't have to pay it back, so you get to revive their economies. I think that's a very positive outlook, and it's so much better than the austerity years.
It's hugely positive, because you mentioned Mario Draghi. We in Ireland, there was a myth that was built up around the fact that I'm correcting myself now. There was a myth built up around that austerity somehow corrected the economy. It was actually Mario Draghi standing up and saying, we will do anything to protect the euro. That's what saved. And it meant that we had access immediately to funds for good, you know, at a price that we could afford to repay. We could reschedule debt, we could rebundle it, and we could do all of these things that helped us build our way out of it. However, in the case of the recovery funds, and I think it's really positive. I've seen the plans of the Spanish government are really positive to build back a different type of economy, a green economy, similar to Portugal. We've spoken to João Pina in the Partido Socialista, and he's spoken about what they want to do. Ireland is on the flip side of this, because our economy is the outlier. We've managed to grow. And within the EU, that stands out like a sore thumb at the moment. Is there much noise around the fact that, let's be honest, you know, our position, along with a couple of other EU states, by the way, there's, you know, I think of the top eight tax havens identified in the world, I think five of them are basically EU countries. Is there much noise around that's on the agenda still?
Yeah, that is. I think, look, nobody's going to interfere in any country's budget unless they breach some of the rules around spending. But that all comes into play when a country sends off its plan. And it does have to be in line with sustainability and global warming and all that kind of thing. Separate to that is Ireland's relationship with the multinationals. And that's definitely on the, you know, on the agenda for many countries, in particular France, who have been trying to push this digital tax. For years, the Commission has been trying to push this consolidated corporate tax base, which is essentially a form of harmonization. And recently, there was an agreement where multinationals would have to, country by country, record how much tax they pay in each member state. And not that anything would come of that necessarily, but that it would be glaring as to how much.
Transparent.
Exactly. Around transparency, country by country reporting. That was something that Ireland voted against, but it was happened to happen outside the finance minister's meeting, so it didn't have to be unanimous. And so there is a start of a shift in that regard. It's just that everyone's so prioritised with COVID at the moment. But I think there's a consensus that we can't continue to allow taxpayers pay for roads and education and so on for multilaterals to just gain from that and not pay tax. I mean, there's an element of fairness. From Irish point of view, they would also say, well, hold on a minute, you know, they do pay tax and we've closed some of the loopholes. There's a definite argument to be had. I mean, that's coming down the road, not too far.
How are you finding Brussels personally at the moment, Shona? Are you finding it more or less restrictive than you think it is here at home?
I know it's less restrictive because obviously the shops and so on are open. And like we're going to next weekend, a sort of a safari park zoo with my son. And you can stay overnight and they bring the food to your room in the evening and your breakfast. But it's very, you know, they only have a certain amount of people allowed in. You have to put your mask on and that kind of thing. But that's just a little glimpse of a bit of outside fun that we're going to be able to have. But it has been really tough, to be honest with you, in January, February, because it was so miserable. The weather was just so bad. I'm working from home a lot, so I didn't see anyone anyway. And actually in Ireland, I did my first lockdown in Ireland, and I actually found it so much more manageable because it was in Ireland, because I was able to go to the Phoenix Park and, you know, see people from a distance. Eventually, I was able to drop over to my parents some food and just be on the doorstep, you know. And I really felt like there was like a camaraderie and family around and friends that like you could just see from a distance every now and again. I haven't had that. I really missed it. I really miss it, actually. It's tough, that part.
And are the schools going okay? Things like that are all working fine?
Actually, they are now. Belgium had one of the worst cases in the world around September, October. So schools were open. But what happened was a lot of them were just closing down because teachers were getting sick. It was grim. And they managed to put that back on track. And the schools are open. And my son is in creche for a couple of hours a day. And that's manageable. And so cases are going up, unfortunately, now. But they haven't actually closed the schools. So that does exist, which is good because you have that bit of continuity.
And long may it last. I know that numbers are rising right across Europe, but schools are something that everybody's keeping a very, very close eye on. So hopefully it lasts, because you need your bit of space
work. Can I ask one last question? Yeah. Sorry, Martin. In terms of the internal borders with neighbouring countries, someone told me yesterday that there's, you know, PCR tests required and Schengen is based on that at the moment. Is that the actual reality on the ground now, that it's... it's on pause again, as it was up until maybe June, July last year, depending on the nation states.
Yeah. So, I mean, every country has its own right to its own, you know, close its border and do what it wants. But obviously, when you're in Schengen, you are part of a group. But for example, Germany had closed down its border with the Czech Republic, and the Austrian-Germany border had closed down for a while. Here in Belgium, I traveled to Lyon on the train in France for work not that long ago, and it was okay there. But they're starting in Germany, other countries, the use of antigen tests, which are immediate. And I think that's key to reopening the single market, because obviously they have to allow essential workers, in particular this time of year, because remember, like, there's a lot of workers who do their fruit picking around the EU. Otherwise, those industries fall apart. So there has to be a realization that, look, the single market needs to continue for essential purposes. And so they are introducing antigen tests for that. So that seems to be the way forward. But at the same time, nobody is moving around because the situation in Germany and other countries is you know, getting bad. And they are, I mean, what happened was in Germany, on the 2nd of March, they started a slow reopening, 2nd of March, 8th of March, and then they've had to halt that. So that's a bit disappointing.
Shona Murray, thank you very much for taking the time out to have this talk with us. And the weather does look glorious there behind you. A bit jealous about that. It's far more grey here today. But thank you for taking the time out to have this chat with us. And we hope we can have a chat with you again in the future.
It was a pleasure to finally catch up with both of you. I really appreciate it. And actually, honestly, I'm delighted to talk to Irish people here in Brussels, so it's great.
Even these two lunatics. No, we really appreciate it, and all the best to you and your son. And mind yourselves; it is difficult everywhere. And I do think it's a really good insight, though, into We were talking to at the weekend to Hannah McCarthy, who's in Beirut, and you know, there's Irish people everywhere, as we know, but they're talking about the fact that we've kind of, in the last 12 months, we've lost a sense of the international perspective on things, which, you know, as you're in individual countries tend to, we're doing a lot more navel gazing in terms of how things are going. But I think we have to keep an eye on that. And the work that you guys do, actually the work Euronews does is terrific as well. So do check that out. Everybody, I'm sure you know Shona's work, but if you don't, it's you'll see her on Twitter and you'll find her on Euronews. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.